Hello and welcome to the Now Spinning Magazine podcast with me, Phil Aston. And in this episode, I'm absolutely delighted to have with me Sid Griffin, vocalist and guitarist from the Long Riders, a band that some say invented the term Americana. In fact, I will read this bit from your website because it's very good. A band that blends the punk rock spirit of the Ramones, the soul of Merle Haggard, the cosmic country of Gram Parsons, and the beautiful jangle of the Byrds into their own uniquely American musical experience. There is nothing quite like the Long Riders live, not back then, and certainly not now. So, how are you doing, Sid? How are you?
Very well indeed. I wonder who wrote that. I would say it's pretty accurate. Whether or not you want to agree with those lofty references, it's certainly accurate about what we do and how we try and do it.
I would say the only thing missing from that is how uplifting, positive, and joyous your music is in these kind of dark times. I mean, that comes through in everything, and especially on this new album, which comes out, I think, on March the 10th, which is absolutely superb, September, November, on the Cherry Red record label.
And there's vinyl as well.
And vinyl as well. In fact, there's an upsurge in appeal for vinyl in the UK and in the US, in fact, around the world. So was it very important to you to have this as a vinyl album as well, with gatefold sleeve?
Yes, it was. But I find that the industry can't, I don't feel the industry can go on with, you can buy something on vinyl, you can buy something on CD, you can buy something as a download to have, and you can stream it. I'm wondering if we won't eventually go and lose at least one of those sources. It's odd. You know, we got down to something like two major vinyl plants in the world, and now they're building vinyl record manufacturing plants for the first time in decades. And I'm just wondering, can the industry sustain on so many avenues? It's a bit crazy. And now, of course, there's a minor, very minor, but noticeable uptick in cassettes, which in my opinion were good for being boat anchors if you had enough of them.
Yes, so, it's a very worrying trend, isn't it? The return of the cassette.
and I wonder how it's going to play out. But definitely, I would tell any band of any stripe, of any kind of genre of music, including classical, if you're going to go out on the road and tour, you'd better take some vinyl.
Yeah, who would have thought it? Because you would have thought, well, that means that, you know, the audience going down the front, you know, with a vinyl album under their arm, you know, because it's not as easy to stick in your pocket as a CD. But it's, you know, fits in with the overlarge tour programs as well. I think the key thing is that, as you were just saying, is maybe if we just had black vinyl rather than multicolored, you know, a green one, a red one, and a yellow splatter vinyl version as well. That probably makes it even more logistically difficult to release anything nowadays, is which color are you going to go for? But anyway, the initial reviews for this album have been really, really positive.
Yeah, man.
And I think it's fantastic. Now, Cherry Red are releasing this, and Cherry Red have been behind you for quite a while because they've also released a few retrospective box sets as well. How did you get involved with Cherry Red Records?
I had a meeting with a guy named Steve Hammond. I was running my own record label called Prima Records LTD.
Yeah.
And doing fairly well with it. We got up to 26 releases.
Wow.
And he came to me and said, basically he was saying, you know, you've kind of taken this as far as you can take it. And if Cherry Red steps in and helps you out, we have the distributorship and the muscle to get things going further. And of course, that's very, very true. It's a bit like we're not in, I tell people that are not in the record industry, I say, we're not in sort of the Premier League of teams like Arsenal and Tottenham and Man United, but we're kind of in the Championship League, which is the next one down when you're with Cherry Red. Or to my American friends, I say, we're not in the major leagues of baseball. We're in the AAA league of baseball. So it's been a real boon to have met Steve Hammond. We've done three box sets. We did an overall Long Riders 4-CD box set. Then we did 3-CD box sets for the two albums on Island Records we had out. And now, right now, we're doing a fourth box set for the Native Sons album, which came out in 84, which is probably our most popular record to this day. It's hit six figures by now. And
wow.
So that'll be out. I'm thinking the Native Sons box set will be out in September this year. If not, about this time next year, something like that.
Fantastic. Well, a lot of my readers and listeners have got those box sets, and they love them because Cherry Road Records are one of those labels that really think through the eyes of a fan. You know, so the attention to detail, you know, and the booklets and the way it's all put together, I think really resonates. So I think that's fantastic. Yeah. Now, this is the first album you've recorded since the sad passing of bassist Tom Stevens. And did this, that obviously affected you all very, very deeply. And there's a song on the album called Tom Tom, which is very, very heartfelt. And I know that you recorded this as a download and released as a download on January 21st, 2022. And you recorded it during the pandemic. So you're all probably in your own little outclaves. How did this song come together? Was it the passing of Tom, or was it you inspired by something else?
The Greg Souders, our drummer, after Tom died, had a dream that Tom came to him and said most of the words that are in the actual verses.
Oh, wow. And
odd, because we never in our lives called him Tom Tom. I not once referred to Tom Stevens as Tom Tom. I don't know where that came from. It would be the Tom Tom on his on a Greg's drum kit, maybe. But you can't lose somebody who's been your bass player since December 1983, when it was, January 2021 when we lost him. You can't have somebody for 38 years and just not mark the passing of that relationship. So we have a song about Tom based on his personality, based on the dream that Greg Souders had about Tom dying, coming to him in a dream and saying these words. And then the bridge, which is the part I contributed, is pretty much compiled of Tom's song lyrics. I sing "You're Flying Away from the Great Cold City," which is the last song on here. Then I sing "Flying Out of London in the Rain," which is the title of the last song here. And then I sing "All Those Years Long Ago." Well, "Years Long Ago" is a Tom Stevens song from our album State of Our Union. "All Those Years Long Ago, comma, We're a Stitch in Time." "A Stitch in Time" is a Tom Stevens song off the album Two-Fisted Tales. And so that's my contribution to make lyrical reference to his titles. Stephen McCarthy, our wonderful guitar player, and Greg Souders, our equally wonderful drummer, wrote most of the rest of the song.
Yeah, because it's a complete band composition, is it? You know, it's absolutely fantastic.
It was recorded down the phone line, which I don't recommend to anybody because the pandemic was on. And we wanted to honor Tom, but you can't physically be in the same room.
Of course.
I'm a big believer in being in the same room. I mean, if you listen to like My Favorite Things by John Coltrane, the studio one, they're all in a room together. You know, Elvin Jones and McCoy Tyner and Coltrane, they're all in a room together, and you get that cohesiveness, which with dance music and much modern pop / rock, you don't get. So I was bummed that we had to do it down the phone line, but that's just the way it was. I do not recommend that for bands that are sort of organic. I don't recommend it.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. The amount of times I talk to people and it's all been dialed in when you look at those old iconic photos of bands in the 60s and 70s all on, you know, stools and chairs, looking at each other in the same studio with just it's very, very different.
You can't replicate that feeling. I'm just off the subject for just a second. On My Favorite Things, I heard it for years. And when the CD came out, I realized McCoy Tyner hits a bad note. He just blatantly, about 8 minutes in, hits a bad note. And you can hear him, as soon as he hits it, he's releasing the keys like, uh-oh. And I think that's part of the record. You know, that makes part of the record. You know, and All My Loving by the Beatles, "Close Your Eyes and I'll Kiss You," McCartney makes a bass note boo-boo because they're all doing the backing track at the same time, and he made a bass note boo-boo. Well, that's great. That's part of it. It's the feel was there, so why get rid of the track?
Absolutely. Now, the song Tom Tom, is that going to be in the live set when you...
Now, that's a very good question, because we found out, particularly with new songs, if the new song's slow, it can ruin the momentum of the set. If the new song is something people are familiar with, you can get away with it. So that is a good question. I could not confirm one way or the other if Tom Tom will be in the show come May, June, and then indeed later on this year, because we're going to do touring in three chunks this year.
I just feel that once people buy the album, they realize what the song's about and the relationship, obviously, to Tom, that it will kind of be almost like having Tom on stage in a way, if that song's in the set.
Yeah, good point.
you know, so I think it will be a favorite over time. The music of The Long Road, as I said, is joyous, upbeat, life affirming, and you know, and this is very true with your lyrics, etc., and very insightful. Now, the track Elmer Gentry is Alive and Well. This seems to affirm what a lot of us are thinking, that the 21st century is a little bit unhinged in places.
Yes. Well, Stephen wrote most of Elmer Gantry. I just sort of crossed the T's and dotted the I's. But I do feel that you've hit the nail right on the head with that hammer. I don't know what's going on in the world. I never dreamed that, say, 40% of the United States would go with a guy who's supposedly the great playboy, but we know he pays for sex, that's supposed to be the great businessman, but his businesses fail and he gets sued all the time, who's supposed to have his finger on the pulse of the public. Well, he does have that 40% support, but the rest of the country despises him. So it's like, I don't know how to explain it. And then you see your mini-me versions of Trump in Brazil with Bolsonaro and in Hungary with Orban. I mean, how did these guys get there? I mean, it's almost – well, a friend of mine, a philosophy friend of mine at University College London said, it's because people would rather believe than understand. They'd rather believe that what they believe is so and this person's great than understand that what they've adhered to might be wrong, or that the person they put their political faith in might be a jerk. They'd rather believe – and understand. I think that sums it up very well.
Yeah, absolutely. Another song that I really love on the album is Flying Down, which sounds like the band coming from a tour and being away. It's very reflective. Was that the kind of imagery going through your mind when the song was pulled together?
Because no one lives near each other. It's a good question. Because no one lives near each other. You know, in the old days, we'd literally, hold on one second. In the old days, we'd literally, somebody would come over to your house.
Yeah.
And I would hand that person this guitar, shall we say.
Yes, beautiful.
And I would take that guitar. And
fantastic.
We'd sit there and I'll grab this for sound. Oh, let me move revolver. Here's a plug.
Yeah.
And we would sit there with guitars, right?
Yeah.
And we'd be face to face. None of this Zoom call like you and I are having a chin wag. We'd sit there face to face and somebody go, la, 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 I love you, Betty. And the other person go, no, how about la, 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 I love you, Betty. That's better. And you'd have a real give and take. And sadly, we can't do that. We don't live near each other. The whole thing's skewered. So it's changed everything, if you follow me.
Yeah.
It's changed everything. So Stephen sent me a... Tom, on the previous album, Psychedelic Country Soul, had sent me some songs, and he sent me some songs, he said, some backing tracks with no words whatsoever, just suggested titles. And I got two songs out of that that were put on the Psychedelic Country Soul album. So when we can't get together over guitars, like, you know, someone would just show up because we've got guitars in each other's homes. We don't need to carry around instruments. Stephen sent me on this new album, this backing track. And he said, here's a backing track, kind of like The Faces. If you remember a guy named Ronnie Wood.
Yeah, I do. Yeah. Great rhythm player. Yeah.
Well, Ronnie Wood was a friend of the Long Riders. We all knew him fairly well. And his carer was a friend of ours. And through her, we met Ronnie. I knew him the last 6-7 years of his life. And so it's this Faces-like track. And I thought we need a kind of a, I know you probably can't hear it because I'm singing it, but it's a Ronnie Lane reflective type lyric. And that Flying Down, I mean, there's some really, I'm really proud of the record. And I'm not just being a wise ass by saying that.
No, brilliant.
But that might be my favorite track on the record. It's just great. Flying Down. The lyric's good. The band's performance is great. Steven's song is good. I'm proud of the lyric. I think it's great. It's a guy, you know, people could construe it as being high on drugs, but it's really a guy reflecting over life and flying over his hometown and looking down at the city or small town and thinking about his life. I think I'm really proud of it. I know it's like saying, don't I have a wonderful house or isn't my wife beautiful? But
No.
As much as I'm trying not to say that, isn't that song great? I'm really proud of it.
It's a fantastic song. And as you say, it's very reflective and you're obviously in a good place all of you. It reminds me, if we go back to 1987, because obviously people think that touring and being with a major record label is very glamorous and it's all fantastic. But back then, although you had a major record deal, you were struggling, lots of you were struggling financially, you were worn out, you were burnt out. The band seems more balanced and happier now in yourselves, now that you're back together. Would that be true?
Well, these are good questions. Yes. There's a short answer, and the longer answer is we don't have anything to prove. We have a upstairs on the wall, we have an award, or I have my for the Americana Trailblazers Award that the Americana Association of the United Kingdom gave us. In Nashville right this second, you can go to their Western Edge display, and along with Emmylou Harris and Dwight Yoakam and Los Lobos and Chris Hillman's Desert Rose Band, you can see a substantial contribution on the contribution of the Longriders. I never thought I would see multiple pictures of myself in the Country and Western Museum in Nashville, Tennessee, or two sets of my lyrics on the wall in a glass case, and a what do you call those things? An interactive thing where you can read about the band and hear various songs and all that sort of crap.
Multimedia, yeah.
I never dreamed that would happen. So while we've never sold millions of records, our place in the pantheon, in the history of alt country and Americana is set. And so there's not as much jockeying for position as there was when we were younger. You know, Tom Petty had to get, I got that phrase from Tom Petty. He said when we had Mud Crutch, everyone's jockeying for position. And then when it became Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers, because Denny Cordell pointed to Tom Petty and said, "Look, with all respect, gentlemen, this guy's the one with the fairy dust on him. Petty, let's focus on him."
Yeah.
And they, you know, that was their best way forward. Now, we did all of that, except we didn't sell those kind of records. We didn't get the kind of radio place. We didn't sell those kind of records. But there's exactly what you said. There's a relaxation to it because we've done what we've done. We have a sales base that is rock solid that you couldn't, unless people start dying off.
Yeah.
We got a great sales base. You know, what's to complain about? And I admit when we go out and play, you know, we play to 1,500 and 1,600 people. And on a bad night, we might pay to 450 people.
But
it's like, whatever. I mean, what the hell? I mean, we go to Stagecoach and play to 27,000 and they know who we are. It's like, I can't complain. I'm trying to think of somebody in New Zealand or Australia or something. I don't know, the Hoodoo Gurus or somebody that didn't really break out. Or, you know, I mean, just you can't complain. I mean, I know I'm being long-winded, but I've got guys back in Kentucky that were better musicians than I was, but they didn't know how to perform. They didn't want to do the work. And now they spent 35 years at a loading dock or whatever. Well, you know, that was their choice. I can't complain about my life. I can't complain about the Longriders.
So, because obviously you, when I was setting up this interview and I was talking to Matt at Cherry Red, I thought, well, I'll need to do this in the evening because obviously for the time difference. And Matt said, no, Sid's in London. So I immediately thought, oh, you must be like just over here doing a recce for the tour. But you've lived in London for a while.
30 years. I married an English girl and that I met on tour, and we're very happily married and we have a family of two kids. And so I must confess, I used to miss I don't miss Kentucky where I'm from that much. Yeah. I used to miss Southern California a great, great deal. And to be just perfectly frank, I don't want to offend anybody, but after the rise of Trump, I do not miss the United States much at all. I mean, I just look at my country and think, you've got to figure about one third of the country's nuts.
Nuts. Thank God for music and rock and roll, eh?
Keeps us
all sane.
I agree.
Yeah. Well, now another song that I really like has no words at all, and it's Song for Ukraine. Now, this is a very somber and dark subject, but the music, even though it has no words, is really positive and feels full of hope. What was the approach to writing that? It's a beautiful piece of music.
Well, tried to learn a Ukrainian folk song because there was a radio station that contacted us before the war. And all right, so I got as far as, I hope it's in tune. I got as far as, let's see if I can hold this up.
Yeah, it's cool. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. right there, I couldn't remember the rest of the song.
So so what happened was I thought, let's just write this song. Let's just write a song. Why do we have to do a Ukrainian folk song that, you know, maybe they might even arguably take offense that I'd screwed it up. So based on this folk melody of one of their traditionally Ukrainian, I want to stress Ukrainian, nothing to do with the rest of that part of the world, Ukrainian folk song. I thought it'd be a good idea to come up with our own melody. And I just, in the studio, it was easy to do. We had people come in and play parts, and unless something was ridiculous, I just let, you know, we just let them go with it. This is the melody based off when I was playing on acoustic guitar, and Stephen McCarthy played some very sympathetic patterns on the mandocella and I think the bass. And we had a track with people play something in league and in sympathy with this scale. We got a very, in my opinion, this may sound again very lofty, but a sort of a Brian Wilson's, one of those instrumentals he would do on an album like Pet Sounds, a very moody, wonderful song, but like the song Pet Sounds or like the song Let's Go Away for a While, they don't really need words. And I think Song for Ukraine, I'm extremely proud of it. I know it's not what people expect, an instrumental that's moody, and you know, the long writers, they probably want pounding 4/4 songs, which is fine, but it was great to get away from that and do Song for Ukraine. Just great.
I think it segues from the track before it and to the one that comes afterwards absolutely perfectly. I think it's,
I had to look to see which tracks.
I think, good. Yeah, I think it works really, really well. And the track also features Karenza Peacock on violin, who's a soloist from the London Symphony Orchestra. And she also plays on That's What They Say About Love and the title track as well. How did she get involved? Is she someone you know?
She and I had, before she moved to, she got, she was Royal Academy of Music. She got offered to play in, she got a good job offer in California. She plays on Disney soundtracks. She's a very, very in-demand session player in Southern California. We had a bluegrass band called the Coal Porters, C-O-A-L, like a chunk of coal.
Yeah.
The Coal Porters bluegrass band. And we went on for a long time. But when Karenza left to go to the United States, you couldn't turn down the, you know, this Disney money gig and the offer of all this stuff. So she went to America to capitalize on that. And so the Coal Porters kind of fell apart. But obviously she's one of my friends, and I've stayed in touch with her. And she's Royal Academy of Music. She's extremely fast. So if you say, Karenza, we've got a bluegrass tune in G. We've got a rock and roll 4/4 boogie in B minor. We've got this crazy song for Ukraine. She can do it like that. And from there, I think we moved on to DJ Bonebreak, who's in a band called X, just X.
Yeah.
And I don't know DJ well. Oddly enough, I used to live around the corner in Los Angeles from 83 to when they moved around 85. I used to live around the corner from John Doe and Xene, the sort of lead songwriting duo of the band X. But I didn't know DJ very well, but certainly he knew who I was and said, yeah, man, come on. I would be honored to be on the song because he plays vibes. It's kind of weird to think that a guy in a famous American cutting edge band for about 40 years now can play vibes, but he can play vibes like he's Lionel Hampton or something. So we got DJ in on there, and I'm really proud. It sounds great.
Fantastic. Well, another two songs that I really love are Now That's What They Say About Love, which I just mentioned, and Until God Takes Me Away. Now, these two songs, to me as a listener, seem related, that the first one is about the magic and spark of falling in love, and the second one lyrically seems a little bit darker or more melancholy. Are they kind of related?
What I'll do, That's What They Say About Love was Steve McCarthy, the guitar player of our band, just mentioned a wonderful image. He said, yeah, I took my wife to see Tony Bennett. And this is like 10 years ago, because, you know, Tony Bennett's now slipping away from us. But 10 or 12 years ago, when he was very much a performing guy that had all his faculties, I like the image of a rock and roll guy, country and Western guy like Steve McCarthy, taking his wife to see Tony Bennett, which is undeniably romantic music, the Great American Songbook. And I wanted to come up with a song that Tony Bennett could sing.
So I came up with those chords. They're actually part of a guitar lesson I was given by the great Robbie Gladwell. Robbie played with Susie Quattro for years, and he played for years with Steve Harley and Cockney Rebel. And Robbie is just a genius. And Robbie sent me these jazz passing chords and said, learn this. And I switched them around and got a song out of it. And of course, by the time you add a Carenza fiddle and Steven doing a jazz solo, you've kind of gone into the hot club of Cowtown, you know, Hot Club of Paris.
Yeah.
I was thinking of the band, the Hot Club of Cowtown, but I meant Grappelli and Reinhardt in the Hot Club of Paris.
Fantastic. Fantastic.
Oh, the other song was Until God Takes Me Away. Was just, you know, when you're a kid, I remember you and your listeners will love this. The pre-band I had before the Long Rose is called the Unclaimed. And my friends used to call us the Unacclaimed. And in the Unclaimed, one day, one guy brought in a song about his girl, and he called it Little Terry. It's a very sentimental song, as guys write when you're in your late teens, early 20s.
Yes.
The singer, in anger, brought in a song the next day or the next rehearsal about his girlfriend, who used to wear a blue jumper with a yellow duck on it, and his song was called Little Duck Girl. And I always laugh about that, the battling sentimental songs about the girlfriends, because it took me years to be able to write a song like Until God Takes Me Away, which is about my missus and this wonderful relationship we're in. But it's the kind of song that people that, if you'll allow me to say it, that are our age, male or female, really relate to. Had we been in the Sex Pistols or the Ramones back in the day, it would have been a silly, inappropriate piece of fluff. But as you get older, people say, oh, it sounds like Landslide by Stevie Nicks and Fleetwood Mac. And it sounds like, and I'm very flattered, because as you get older, a song like Until God Takes Me Away has a heavier meaning. I mean, we lost Tom Stevens. God took Tom away. So the woman upstairs, my wife, Rhiannon, who's upstairs now working in the NHS out of our daughter's bedroom, she has my love until God takes me away. And that's the kind of thing that people relate to now at my age, at our age. And of course, back in the day, it had been laughable. The guys in the band room would have been,
But I think that's important, that as musicians, and, you know, realize, you know, the emotive power of writing music for the audience as we travel through life together. You know, and I think these, as you say, when I was younger, teenager, lyrics like that, I wouldn't have even registered them on my radar. You know, I was too busy rocking down the highway and all
exactly.
The rest of it.
Whereas now,
I think I've just, you know, we've recently lost Gary Rossington from the band Lynyrd Skynyrd. And I think the reason why people feel so connected to when somebody from their musical soundscape of their lives disappears, passes over, is that because we know that ourselves, because we're getting older, that we're kind of following them. You know, there is more time behind us than ahead of us. And so lyrics like this, and I think that's why it's such a fantastic song. I think it will connect, you know, with your audience on a deeper level than it would have done in the mid-80s.
Well, I agree, and I must interject. You know, sometime in the mid-70s, the dinner table at the Griffin's house in Kentucky, my parents start talking about who died. Sometime in the mid-70s, and it was like, you know, be it a celebrity like the baseball player Joe DiMaggio or Wallace Beery from the movies of the 30s and 40s, they'd say, do you know who died? And it might be a celebrity from their youth, a movie star in the old black and white film days of Hollywood, or it might be a person down the street or someone that one of them went to high school with. And I now realized I'm not quite, but I'm almost at that age where the dinner table conversation is, you know, honey, did you hear Fred Jenkins passed? Honey, did you know Diane Floor Flusher's cancer finally claimed her yesterday morning? And it's ridiculous not to reflect that. The other thing I wanted to interject is the great Nick Lowe was a few, 10 or 15 years ago, decided, why am I don't want to be this guy that tries to get into his leather britches anymore and rocks out. I want to reflect my age. So he started turning out brilliant albums like The Impossible Bird and At My Age, where Nick Lowe embraces old age and loss and celebrates indeed the friendships and the loves that have passed. So that's kind of what the Long Riders, it's not kind of, it's what the Long Riders are trying to do.
I would say that definitely that's what I felt listening to this album. Flying Out of London closes the album, and that one was written by and features Tom Stevens. Was this always going to be the final track on the album because of, you know,
once we started cutting it, Tom had a wonderful solo album called Home, H-O-M-E. And it came out on a little label called Avebury, and a lot of people passed it by, although, to be fair, it did get really good reviews in the UK. So I said to the guys, on this new album, it would be nice that Tom has a presence other than just Tom. And they went, I said, actually, let's do one of Tom's songs and not just honor him by doing one of his songs where Steven sings it or I sing it. Let's have Tom do it. So we contacted his family, who we're all very close with.
Yeah.
And they sent us I said, here's six or seven Tom songs that are long writers appropriate. The band and our producer at the Great Ed Stasium, they picked Flying Out of London in the Rain. I actually wanted another song. And they said, no, it's this one. So we got the files, as we call it in this digital world, from the Stevens family, and kept Tom's bass, kept Tom's vocal, kept the backing vocals, which are by his daughter, Sarah.
Oh, beautiful.
And most of the rest of the track we replaced. It's Greg's drums. Steven plays a couple of guitar passes. I play at least one guitar pass, and I play the mandolin. And as I recall, does Steven and I sing? I can't remember. Anyway, so you have all four of the main songwriters on one song on the album, which ends the album. And even more germane to the story is Flying Out of London in the Rain, which I don't think the band knew when they picked it.
Yeah.
Was Tom's song about leaving the songwriters for the first time in 1987.
Oh, wow.
Tom started a family with Sarah Stevens, the aforementioned daughter who sings the ha 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 backing vocals on the track. And she was a babe of about 18 months. And he said, I've been away for a good chunk of my daughter's first 18 years on the planet. So he quit the band to be a family man, which is a very good father, very good family man. And that's what the song's about. We ended a European tour. We got on the plane at Heathrow. We're flying back. And he said, over the Atlantic, I decided I've got to leave the band. I can't do this anymore. It's not fair to my family. If we were making scads of money, I would stay in the band and, you know, buy the family a mansion. But since we're just getting by, it's not right. None of the other of us were married then, and none of the others of us had a kid then. So he was very much on his own. So it's a very poignant song. Tom's on it. His daughter's on it. And it's about leaving the songwriters the first time. We had to replace him, and we had a different bass player for about 6 months, and then just completely fell apart.
Wow, fantastic. Thank you for sharing that. Because your first album for 32 years was Psychedelic Country Soul.
Yeah.
And that was your comeback album after 32 years. When you start to put together the live set, which I presume you're doing even as I speak, probably behind the scenes.
I was doing it this morning. Yes. I was on the computer looking at the sets of I've interrupted, but I was doing it this morning. Sorry.
Yeah. So, because I know with a band with your kind of heritage, it must be difficult to balance what your audience really want to hear, to take them back to when they were younger, to what you're promoting now, and to also recognize, you know, our tracks like, is it Grenville, isn't it? That is one of the fantastic tracks from that album. Will you be including songs from that album as well?
Sure, of course. It is. Tom wanted to do a vote, a plebiscite, where name your favorite songwriter song, and we had to do the top 10 songwriter songs. Well, we know Looking for Lewis and Clark is one, and we know Stevens. My favorite song is by the songwriters is Stevens' song I Had a Dream with the 12 string and all that. So we knew they'd be on there. So what are the other eight? So we try and do most of the other eight if we can. It's, you know, if you're Neil Young or Paul Weller, they literally just do what they want. Neil Young and Paul Weller go out and they don't play Heart of Gold, and he doesn't, Weller doesn't play you know, That's Entertainment or a jam hit or even a Style Council hit if he doesn't want to. They do what they want to do. We don't have that luxury. We have a loyal fan base that wants to hear some of the old stuff. So
For example, I had to put Run Dusty Run to bed because I just couldn't sing it anymore. And now after COVID, not having to sing it, I can now sing it again. But I had a couple tours there where I told the band, I'm not singing that. Even though it was the number one, how many digits am I holding up? Number one song voted more than Lewis and Clark, I Had a Dream. Now I can sing it again. I'll be happy to. But for a while there, it's like, oh my God. You know, I had a friend, I should probably tell you this, but I won't tell you the band, but back in LA, I had some friends that had a couple of hit singles, and they said, the main thing wrong with having a hit single is after a tour or two, you're sick to death of it. Because you got to do it here, you got to do it there. You go take a guitar to be on a radio station, and they'll say, do a few bars of your big hit. Oh, God. At soundcheck, the guy, all right, we'll finish up with do the hit so I can get the, oh,
yeah, but I think it is finding the right balance, isn't it? Because that's why, I mean, in this interview, I focused very much on your new album because, you know, that's where you all are. That's what you recently created. And, you know, and that's where you are in your hearts and, you know, musical endeavors as well. Now, when you go out on tour, the merch store, I think you mentioned at the very beginning, you obviously, you all have the CD available, but also the vinyl album.
Man, I'm ordering them later today. Hold on. I'm coming back.
That's okay.
I'm ordering them later today.
Oh, look at that, everybody.
That's vinyl. That's not
yeah,
a
gatefold sleeve as well. Fantastic.
It's like a White Album gatefold. It's
yeah, yeah.
And then there's that. And then the lyrics are on the, there's no CD booklet. The lyrics are on the 12-inch vinyl. In fact, we've got our own logo. I don't know if you can see that. We've got our own logo.
I can see that. Yeah, that looks.
It's great. This is a very minor thing. I can tell. I've been looking at. Is that Judy Zuki?
Yeah, it is. Yeah,
I've been looking at the records over your shoulder, trying to identify some stuff. And you would get a you would get a kick out of this. One crazy thing I'm proud of. Not only is this a good album cover.
Yeah.
It was done by Phil Smee. Phil Smee's the UK's leading graphics guy, and he's been my friend since '85. Phil Smee's most famous for he did the Motorhead logo with the umlauts over.
He's
a genius. He's an absolute genius. But Phil and I were laughing. I said, I think this is the first album I've ever put out in my career with solo albums and bluegrass albums and songwriters albums that has – I've looked everywhere. There's no – typographical error or grammatical error or spelling error anywhere on it. Usually there's some small, I've never had a big one like, you know, the song title's misspelled. I've never had one of those. But usually if you read through the lyrics, maybe the word automobile is misspelled, or they've moved automobile from this line to this line, which is incorrect. Yeah. One minor but tangible thing I'm proud of is I don't see any graphic, artistic or grammatical or typographical error anywhere on this package. I think it's just so great. Steven, mind you, our guitar player on the left here, handsome devil that he is, he doesn't like this photograph because we're all in shorts. He says it looks like we're greeting campers on the first day of summer camp, which kind of makes me laugh.
Yeah, well, it just goes with the joyous, uplifting image that your music portrays.
Here's three guys. We took a day off and went to a baseball game.
Yeah.
We're never together. And Ed's not a young man. He was working his ass off 16-hour days. He said, guys, I need a day off where I just sleep in late and drink diet soda all day. So we went to the San Diego Padres baseball game. And you don't see that in a lot of modern indie records, three jerks at a ball game. We handed the phone to the lady behind us, this lovely Mexican-American lady and her family, and said, would you take our picture? So it's, it's a very joyous uplifting.
The imagery gives the impression that if we walked into a bar, you just sit down and have a beer with you. It's just like approachable, real people. Now, how many with an album like this? And I've picked out some of my favorites, but which tracks do you think are going to make it into the live set? Without doubt.
September, November sometime. We already played last November on a Outlaw Country cruise run by Sirius XM. They have a cruise that goes around the wherever Caribbean and one that goes to Mexico and back out of San Pedro Harbors. We pronounce San Pedro. San Pedro Harbors, it's pronounced in L.A. So we've done one of each, and we played September, November on that cruise. And I think we played Elmer Gantry's Live and Well once on that cruise. We played Seasons Change, because then we landed after the cruise and did four or five shows up and down the California coast. So we have played September, November sometime. We have played Seasons Change. We have played Elmer Gantry's Alive and Well already. And those are the only ones. I'm sure we'll work up Flying Down, because we all love it so very, very much. And I would think we'd look up To the Manor Born. But as for the rest, I'm not really sure. We'll do half the album, at least five songs, if not
fantastic.
Seven.
And the album comes out on March the
10th. I've got 2 days. I think it's Friday.
Yeah. And where's the best place for people to buy it? Do you prefer people to buy it from your website? Or?
Well, you can buy, I think Cherry Red's website is the best. And
yeah.
The second best might be something like our friend Jeff Bezos at Amazon or one of those.
Yeah, one of those people. Yeah.
I have a website, but I'm trying to get away from being a retail guy, because the problem is, we have, as I've said before, we have a tangible indie audience. And then I go away for 2 or 3 weeks on tour. We usually try and do tours in 3 weeks, because Greg has a job and I have a special needs child. So there's commitments.
Yeah.
But if you go away for 3 weeks and somebody's just ordered your record, they're pretty PO'd, because I try and I try and turn it around quickly. One of the things, when I was a little boy, I sent $2.50 in to get a Rin Tin Tin doll from a cereal package.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I was so young, I thought you mailed the letter and the next day or the day after
it would happen.
The toy came back. I literally thought it took like 36 hours and the toy came back to your house. And of course, it took like 3 weeks. When you're a small kid, that's the longest 2 or 3 weeks of your life. So If I do it retail, it's nasty, because I come off tour and there's literally 27 people saying, where's my – oh, God. So we're going to try Cherry Red have it. There's a distributor in the United States whose name escapes me that has it. The Amazons of the world are already advertising it now, and it will not be hard to purchase a hard copy.
Fantastic. Mm-hmm. Right. And you must almost be in pre-rehearsal time for the tour, which kicks off in May, on the 19th of May, Leamington Spa.
Well, what we're doing is we always do this. We decide on the set list, and we're big boys. We say, everyone learn these songs, because we live in so many different places. And we do one or two rehearsals before a tour, and that's it.
Wow.
That's it.
Yeah.
You learn these songs. I mean, obviously, we know how Looking for Lewis and Clark goes. We know how Run, Dusty, Run goes. But you still have to rehearse them, don't you?
Yeah, of course, yeah.
But other than that, it's like, learn these new songs and learn them in this order, because we try and play what we call mini suites. In other words, I see a lot of bands, da-da-da-da, stop, and then they dick around for a while, and then the next song. It's my understanding – We got this from the Plimsolls, Peter Case's old rock and roll band, and he got it from the Jam. It's my understanding that we always believe that 1 + 1 + 1 = 5. In other words, you do one song, stop, you get that applause. If you do one song, I go like Dee Dee Ramone, thank you, 2, 3, 4. You go to the next one. At the end of that second song, I go, thank you, 2, 3. And we go into that 1 + 1 + 1 adds up to 5. Those three songs together, you don't get the 3-song applause. You get the applause if you've done 5 songs. So we try and do songs in a suite as close together as we can. And then on the set list, there's break. It says like 2 songs, break. 3 or 4 songs, stop. And I will stop and say, we're the Long Riders. I talk. Steven or Greg retune. They have a sip of water. And I distract the audience by saying, it's lovely to be here in Wellington, you know, blah, blah, blah. And that works. We try not to do one song stop ever. So we're not just learning the songs for rehearsal. We're learning a show.
You're learning a show. Yeah, absolutely. Brilliant. Well, my last question, and this has just come up because I've seen so many guitars during this interview, and you've obviously got a lot of them. Which guitars do you always take on tour with you? Do you have favorites?
I got a new, not new, but new to me. I got, I have a new Rickenbacker 370 with 3 pickups. It's maple. It's upstairs. And it's got bird wiring, which is what McGuinn did, not in the 60s when he put in a treble booster, which basically his treble booster of 1966, you flipped it on, you got a very trebly sound, but you didn't get compression. And with that sound, you got... you got this like Niagara Falls hiss.
Yeah.
That was the technology of the day. So I've got the one that came out around 72. I've got the reissue of that. That is, in my opinion, as good a Rickenbacker as you'll find anywhere. And I run it through a compressor, which is how you get, by the way, that's how you get the bird sound. It's run through a compressor. It's not plugged into an amp. You plug the compressor in, then run it through the amp. That's how you get the Tambourine Man turn, turn, turn sound. Okay. And I will probably take, this is an embarrassment, but as I get older, the heavier guitars have to go. It hurts my shoulder. So I will probably take the weight relieved, Les Paul, which still weighs 7.5 pounds, but the ones that weigh 9, 9.5 pounds are out the window now. So I'll probably take that. There is a Les Paul sitting at Greg Souter's house in the United States. So I have a guitar in the United States. If I go there, I don't have to keep traveling. I can only take the 12 string, but it'll probably be a weight relief Les Paul and this 370. And I take the mandolin just to rehearse it. I'm going to get a mandolin.
And not the Stratocaster.
No, that I played the Strat with the Longriders for 30 years. And I've kind of gotten away from it. That one, oddly enough, is a brilliant one. Everyone's like, wow, it's so rare. It's one of those choral ones in the early 60s. It's not. It's a copyright infringement. Southeast Asia and in China. You know what a Chibson is? A Chibson is a Chinese Gibson that's as illegal as a counterfeit bill. You know, there's no $3 bill. Well, it's a $3 bill. It's called a Chibson. You know, they make Gibsons that look just like Gibsons, but they're fake, and only the experts can spot it.
Wow.
That one I bought for $75. It's the best Stratocaster I've ever heard. It plays fantastically. And when I took it to the aforementioned luthier, Robbie Gladwell, he opened it up and said, this is exactly what I thought. This was made in either Burma or Thailand. It is in an intellectual copyright infringement. They have no, you know, it's not by Fender. It never saw California. And what can I say? It's a brilliant guitar. I mean, Clapton wishes he had that guitar. I mean, it is unbelievable. The pickups, you know, people don't realize wood ages, of course, but pickups and metal age as well. And that thing sounds so fantastic. It's if you like the guitar tone of Layla and the first Eric Clapton solo album called Eric Clapton. I'm not saying you like Clapton or his music. If you like that guitar tone, that one's it.
Fantastic. Yeah, and tonality probably closer to the Rickenbacker than a Les Paul in a way.
And funny enough, I forgot I have an Orange Gretsch 6120 I've been using on the last few tours. I love that guitar. I mean, I love it. But it's one of those things, you know, if someone steals a Stratocaster you bought for $75 and it fixed up, well, but if someone steals, you know, some of these other guitars, it's like, ouch.
That's a real,
you know, they're insured, but it's still, you got to be careful as you get older. These things appreciate wildly.
Well, thank you very much for your time today, Sid. And I just want to remind everybody that the album is out on March the 7th on Cherry Red Records. You can get it from Cherry Red or Amazon. And make sure you also check out longriders.com. And the tour kicks off on the 19th of May in Leamington Spa, which sees you go through the UK and then off to Germany and Denmark by the look of it. Are you off to the USA after that?
Yeah, we're going to do the USA in summer. Mongrel, our booking agency in San Francisco, are doing some shows now. They're looking for an anchor gig at one of these two festivals to base the dates around. Then in September, October, we come back late September, early October, and do Europe again. I've got David Williams in Australia trying to bring us over there, and Lincoln Meyerson in New Zealand trying to or making waves about bringing us over there. So I'm hoping we play those two places. I've played Australia with Billy Bragg, but I've never played Australia with the Longriders, nor have we ever visited New Zealand. So we're hoping that happens, and we think we'll be in Japan again.
Oh, fantastic. So it's going to be a very, very busy year indeed.
It is. It really is. And I'm really excited. Really excited.
Well, September, November is the new album by the Longriders. It's absolutely fantastic. And make sure you go out, everybody, listen to it and buy it. It's been great talking to you, Sid. And take care. And hopefully I'll talk to you again in the future. Thank you very much.
I hope so. Bye,
everyone. Thank you so much for tuning in. And a special thank you to Sid Griffin from the Longriders for taking his time today to talk to me about the new album, which is absolutely superb, and the tour, which, of course, kicks off in May this year. You can buy the album from Cherry Red Records or, of course, from Amazon, but I recommend Cherry Red. There's also some fantastic box sets for the Long Riders if you want to know more about them. And check out longriders.com, where you can find all the latest tour news and information about the band. Please check out Now Spinning magazine as well, the website, the YouTube channel, the Facebook community, and wherever else we hang out on social media. And if you're new to the podcast, please subscribe, tell your friends, tell your family, tell everybody. And I look forward to talking to you on my next episode.